Hello and welcome to the second part of The Descent of Man, our special series on the extraordinary renaissance of Darwinian thinking about human behaviour. Today, Tom Morton takes a closer look at the new Darwinian psychology, which claims to be developing a unified theory of the human mind on evolutionary principles. We begin with a curiosity. What does evolutionary psychology have in common with one of America's most notorious terrorists?
The whole history of the world, although of a length quite incomprehensible by us, will hereafter be recognized as a mere fragment of time compared with the ages which have elapsed since the first creature was created. From the war of nature, from famine and death, the production of higher animals directly follows. There's grandeur in this view of life, having been originally breathed into a few forms or into a single one. From so simple a beginning, endless forms, most beautiful and most wonderful, have been and are being evolved. In the distant future, I see open fields for far more important researches. Psychology will be based on a new foundation. Light will be thrown on the origin of man and his history. Charles Darwin, The Origin of Species, 1859.
For 18 years, US authorities have been searching for the person whose letter bombs have killed three people and injured 21 more. He's been dubbed the Unabomber from the first letters of university and airlines, the early targets of his bombs. Now, federal agents have raided an isolated cabin near Lincoln, Montana, taking into custody 54-year-old Theodore Kaczynski. Kaczynski had been living at the remote site without telephone or power for several years. In April last year, the Unabomber claimed his most recent victim, a forestry executive who died after opening a package. Then, 8 months ago, the New York Times and Washington Post printed the Unabomber's Radical Manifesto, which denounced science and technology. The newspapers reluctantly published the document after the bomber threatened if they did not, he would kill again.
I attribute the social and psychological problems of modern society to the fact that society requires people to live under conditions radically different from those under which the human race evolved.
The words of Theodore Kaczynski, the Unabomber, from his Unabomber Manifesto. Kaczynski was arrested in 1996 and is now serving four consecutive life sentences. He was a kind of radical latter-day Luddite who railed against the Industrial Revolution and all that followed it. In an eerie way, his manifesto echoed what a new generation of Darwinian psychologists are saying about the human mind, that it's fundamentally out of tune with modern life.
We have a Stone Age brain in a modern environment. Human recorded history is an eye blink of human evolutionary history. For the last several million years, we lived in hunter-gatherer groups, and the desires we have are the evolved desires of our ancestors.
David Buss, the author of Evolutionary Psychology, The New Science of the Mind. This new science claims to be fulfilling Darwin's prophecy that psychology would one day be based on a new foundation, an evolutionary foundation. Now, if you were listening to last week's program, you will have heard a lot about mating, both human and animal. Evolutionary psychologists can't stay away from this subject, and neither can we. So later on, we'll hear how David Buss surveyed 10,000 men and women in 37 cultures to come up with the evolutionary formula for a perfect match. To understand this new science, though, we need to travel back into the prehistory of the human mind. evolutionary psychologists believe that natural selection designed our minds for life on the African savanna, where our hunter-gatherer ancestors lived hundreds of thousands of years ago. Well, of course, human societies have changed out of all recognition since then. But underneath it all, say the evolutionary psychologists, we still have Stone Age minds in modern skulls. One of the most passionate exponents of this view is Steven Pinker, who's director of the Center for Cognitive Neuroscience at MIT.
If you look at human behavior today, a lot of it doesn't seem terribly adaptive. We forego childbearing to climb the corporate ladder. We eat ourselves into an early grave with too much junk food. We obsess over celebrities and fictitious characters that we've never met instead of going out and finding mates or raising as many children as we can. We take drugs if they're available, even though they compromise our functioning. There's an endless list of things that we do that make no sense from a narrow biological point of view. On the other hand, they do make sense when you recognize that every single one of them is a response to some recent bit of human technology that's been around for an eye blink in the human evolutionary scene, and that for the 99% of the of human existence in which we lived in nomadic hunter-gatherer bands, these temptations didn't exist.
So, strip away the shoulder pads and the mobile phones, the designer suits and the brand-name sportswear, and underneath there's a cave person cast adrift in a modern world. It's not a new idea, of course, but evolutionary psychologists have a new explanation for why it should be so. All the significant evolution of our minds, they say, took place before the first great cultural revolution which transformed our lives, the invention of agriculture.
It's only been 10,000 years or so since the Neolithic Revolution, since humans first started settling down and building cities and growing their food and a division of labor. For all we know, there could have been evolution since then, but 10,000 years is a drop in the bucket compared to the 6 to 8 million years since we separated from chimpanzees.
Evolutionary change is very slow. If things were happening very quickly, then what this would mean is that different modern human populations would be genetically very different from each other in important respects. And there's all sorts of evidence that that's not true. That when you actually go out and look at the genes that are present in one human population versus another human population, there are some minor differences, but nobody's found you know, a large set of genes which are present in one race or one population, which are absent in other human races or other human populations. We all are interfertile. We all look as if we have the same basic equipment. And that wouldn't be the case if natural selection was operating very quickly. And since we know very few genetic changes have taken place since the rise of agriculture in the human species, we know that basically our modern human brains are Stone Age minds inside, you know, modern human societies.
John Tooby, co-director of the Center for Evolutionary Psychology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. The key to understanding what's new about evolutionary psychology is the notion that our minds are an adaptation. They evolve to meet challenges in the environment, challenges faced by our hunter-gatherer ancestors in their daily lives.
An adaptation in the technical sense is a product of natural selection. That is, it's a feature of the organism that's there because of its effect on helping the organism's ancestors survive and reproduce. In the case of humans, the idea is that we're not specialized in speed or poison or sharp fangs or armor, that the primary novel human adaptation is in figuring out how the world works, that human beings everywhere are good intuitive psychologists so that we can predict one another's behavior and act together in novel ways to bring about outcomes that a single person acting alone couldn't do. We can cooperate, say, to drive animals from several sides and ambush them. We have a kind of intuitive biology and chemistry that we use to try to make sense of the juices and powders that can be extracted from plants and animals so that we can develop poisons and medicines and food additives. And In every human society, you find a way of life that depends crucially on learning and figuring out how the physical and social environment works.
So, according to evolutionary psychology, when we lived on the African savannah, our minds became specialized to deal with the everyday problems of being a hunter-gatherer. We can imagine these specializations as a kind of customized software which evolution has installed in our minds. That, at any rate, is the view of John Tooby. He and his wife and co-researcher Leda Cosmides have been two of the leading pioneers of evolutionary psychology. Unfortunately, Leda Cosmides was ill when we recorded this program. John Tooby says we have to leave behind the notion that our minds are blank slates when we come into the world.
The notion of the blank slate is something that's had enormous cultural appeal and has been the standard, we call it the standard social science model for the 20th century. And yet, I think this model is now passing away. And the notion that marks off evolutionary psychology into a significant departure, which really changes things fundamentally throughout the social sciences, is the claim, and I think we have a substantial amount of evidence that this is true, that instead of having a single general learning system, we have a large number of specialized, functionally specific mental programs that are built into our minds, and that they impose their own structure on things like how you form friends, how you fall in love, how when you feel indignant or enraged that somebody has cheated you, that impose a kind of underlying set of mental concepts and ways of feeling about the world, which people, despite the reputations of anthropologists of having discovered remarkable amounts of human variation, at an underlying level, if you go beneath the surface, what you find is an enormous amount of uniformity in how people think and how people feel.
Evolutionary psychology likes to talk about the psychic unity of humankind. Whether you're an Aboriginal Australian or a New York Jew, a professor of psychology in Vienna or a goat herder in Ghana, the claim is that the underlying structure of your mind is the same. We all share the same mental programming, the programming which our common hunter-gatherer ancestors had. But recently, archaeologists have taken issue with this view. They say that evolutionary psychology has paid too little attention to the archaeological record and what that tells us about the lives of our early human ancestors. One of those archaeologists is Stephen Mithen, author of The Prehistory of the Mind.
Many people today still have assumptions about what our past was like, rather than actually getting and looking at what our past was like. We know that our ancestors lived by hunting and gathering, and one of the problems is we have some hunters and gatherers still living in the world and still surviving, like the Inuit Eskimo or the Kung Bushmen or Australian Aborigines groups. And I think the one of the errors that Cosmides and Tooby slipped into was assuming that all of our prehistoric hunter-gatherer ancestors were just like, say, the Kung Bushmen today, who live in rather small, highly mobile groups, the very egalitarian. But what archaeologists have found out during the last 30 years is that when you look at the past, there's many, many different ways to be a hunter-gatherer. Hunter-gatherers lived in such a wide variety of environments. The past is much more complex and rich and diverse than I think some of the evolutionary psychologists would allow for in their views.
When you look at contemporary hunters and gatherers, the diversity of hunter-gatherer social organisation is enormous. So you can move from societies in which monogamy is the norm, in which people live in groups that are fundamentally egalitarian, lacking social hierarchy and so on and so forth, to instances where hunters and gatherers actually have quite hierarchical societies, will have quite high levels of polygamy sometimes, and so on and so forth.
Howard Morphy is Professor of Anthropology at University College London. He's currently a research fellow at the ANU, and he's an expert on Australian Aboriginal art and anthropology.
Within Australia, you get enormous variability, which cross-cuts things that Australian hunters and gatherers would have in common. At one level, Aboriginal society, terms of its mode of adaptation, in terms of aspects of its religious structure, kinship systems, shows tremendous similarities from the Western Desert right across to Arnhem Land, Cape York Peninsula. In other ways, it shows tremendous difference. So you get actually quite high levels of polygamy in some parts of Arnhem Land, not all. Very low rates of polygamy in the Western Desert. So, actually making generalisations from the Australian data is very difficult.
That's a totem dance recorded near Derby in Western Australia in 1968. Evolutionary psychology insists that underneath all of this broad cultural variation, the essential structure or grammar of human minds is the same. Our thoughts and feelings are all governed by the same mental programs. And in fact, evolutionary psychology goes one step further. The mind is what the brain does, says Steven Pinker, and what the brain does is information processing, essentially similar to the kind of information processing which is done by computers. We all have the same computers in our heads, and all those computers are hardwired in the same way.
Thinking is a form of information processing. Thought and feeling consist of patterns of activity in the brain. They're patterns of activity in the nervous system. And whenever you talk about a pattern causing a pattern in a systematic way, you're talking about computation in a very broad sense. Not in the sense of what the CPU in your computer does, because that's a very different kind of beast than what you can make out of neural tissue. But the idea that there are systematic patterns in the brain that correspond to thoughts and that correspond to feelings, and that one of these patterns triggers another in some systematic way, some coherent way that corresponds to goal-directed behavior or goal-directed thought. Pinker goes on at great length about how what minds do is deal with information. Now, I want to insist that what minds and brains are not computers. That is, computers deal with information. You pull out a file on your computer, it's a bit of dead information, you manipulate it, you put it back, and it stays there till you want it again. What brains and minds do is deal with meaning.
Stephen Rose, Professor of Biology at the Open University in London. Stephen Rose and Steven Pinker are used to slugging it out. They've conducted a lively public dialogue about the nature of the human mind. Rose is highly critical of evolutionary psychology. He sees it as just one of a number of manifestations of what he calls ultra-Darwinism, a particularly extreme form of biological determinism which wants to reduce all of human experience and motivation to one fundamental drive, replicating our DNA. And Rose thinks that comparing the mind with a computer is an analogy which impoverishes rather than enriches our understanding.
Now let me give you an example which comes from Pinker, because he talks about the information which is present if you're walking along the beach and you see a footprint.
Think of Robinson Crusoe walking along the beach and seeing a footprint. OK, what's he got to do when he sees a footprint? First of all, yes, he has to see and interpret the shape in the sand. That's a matter of perception. Secondly, he's got to relate that shape in the sand to his past experience of footprints, so he's got to give it meaning in terms of a human foot. And thirdly, that foot is charged with emotion. Is this a friend? Is this an enemy? It means someone else is on my island. Have I got to greet them? Have I got to look out for danger? Whatever. A fascinating compilation of things which are all about what minds and humans do and nothing at all about what computers do. So I challenge from the very beginning the idea that the mind is simply a computational device.
Steven Pinker's thinking about how the mind works has been heavily influenced by the ideas of John Tooby and Leda Cosmides. Tooby and Cosmides insist that the mind is essentially a highly sophisticated computer. And because we still have the same kinds of brains as our Stone Age ancestors, they say, we must also have the same minds.
Many lines of independent evidence demonstrate that humans are a species whose design was established more than 10,000 years ago, and that we all share this basic human design. And that must be, since our mental activity is rooted in the designs of our brains, brain neuroanatomy, that must be true for our minds as well.
Fundamental to the idea of evolutionary psychology is that there hasn't been enough time since the Pleistocene era for humans to change their ways and their habits in genetic terms. Now, that's absolutely untrue. 600 generations or so is plenty of time for huge amounts of genetic change to take place. So there can have been an enormous amount of change, and indeed there has been an enormous amount of change in human genetic makeup since the Pleistocene. But even more, because we don't know how people lived in the Stone Age period, what you get in all these accounts of evolutionary psychology is what I call the Flintstone view of how people lived. That is, you take American suburban life back in the 1950s or so, and you project it back into the Stone Age, and you say there were Stone Age people living in their little detached houses with gardens around them and sort of pet dinosaurs or whatever else it might be. And that's how they lived then, so that's how we live now.
Wilma, I can't sleep.
What's wrong now, Fred?
Wilma, are you sure you want to go through with this?
I wish you'd relax, Fred. Look at me. I'm calm.
Why shouldn't you be? Your wife isn't having a baby. Hey, what are you doing?
I just wanted to get
it. Let me do it. Whatever you want, I'll always get it. Here you are, Wilma. How about some shrimp and marmalade compote?
Uh-uh.
A chocolate-covered hard-boiled egg on a stick?
Uh-uh.
Oh, you love this. Sardines smothered in prune whip. No? Oysters a la mode?
Fred, are you...
Wait, don't tell me. You want a sandwich. Lobster and hot fudge on pumpkin.
No.
Oh, I give up. What were you going to get?
A glass of water.
Water? Boy, you don't know nothing about having a baby.
Fred, please try to relax.
Fred and Wilma Flintstone, preparing for the birth of their daughter, Pebbles. Well, as you'll have gathered by now, there's almost nothing about evolutionary psychology which isn't hotly debated and vigorously contested. Perhaps most controversial of all is what this new science of the mind has to say about sex. As we've heard, evolutionary psychologists believe that our minds come pre-equipped with a very wide range of mental programs or modules. Some of these are for practical matters, like figuring out which kinds of foods are edible and which aren't. But others are for matters of the heart. They control the complex dynamics of our emotional lives, who we make friends with, why we feel guilt or shame or gratitude or grief. We even have a module to help us choose a mate. So, back in the Stone Age, when a hunter-gatherer's mind idly turned to thoughts of love, she had an inbuilt mental module which helped her to decide who to mate with. According to evolutionary psychology, these modules are still embedded in our minds today.
Mr. Irving Berlin often emphasizes sin in a charming way. Mr. Coward, we know, wrote a song or two to show sex was here to stay. Richard Rogers, it's true, took a more romantic view of this sly biological urge, but It really was Cole who contrived to make the whole thing merge. He said that Belgians and Greeks do it. Nice young men who sell antiques do it. Let's do it. Let's fall in love. Monkeys, whenever you look, do it. Ali Khan and King Farouk, do it. Let's do it. Let's fall in love. All famous writers.
Noel Coward with a little meditation on mating, adapted from Cole Porter. How and why we choose our mates is a subject which fascinates evolutionary psychologists. David Buss, who's Professor of Psychology at the University of Texas, has surveyed more than 10,000 men and women from 37 different cultures to find out what they look for in a mate.
There were some things that were universally desired by men and women everywhere in all cultures. So things like intelligence, kindness, dependability, emotional stability, good health, also mutual attraction and love. These were things that both men and women everywhere wanted and very highly placed in their mate preferences.
David Buss and his research team surveyed men and women in Africa, Europe, Asia, and North and South America. While they found many similarities in what men and women looked for in a mate, they also found what Buss claims are some universal sex differences.
This was the most controversial and shocking aspect of the study, because before I did this study, it was widely believed that what people wanted in a mate was highly variable across cultures and was basically culture-bound. And when we found universal sex differences, this violated every existing theory in psychology. And what we found is that that women more than men valued economic resources, financial stability, as well as the qualities. It wasn't even so much money, but it was the qualities that led to resource acquisition. So a man's ambition, industriousness, his drive, and social status, and also somewhat older age. These were the things that women valued more than men. And in contrast, men valued only two things more than women did. One was physical attractiveness and also youth. They want partners who are younger than they are. How much younger depends on how old the man is. What we found is that as men get older, they desire partners who are increasingly younger than they are. And basically the rationale for these and why we had predicted these sex differences is youth is a cue to fertility. The physical appearance of the woman provides a wealth of information about her fertility. And then women want a good provider, someone who will be there through lean times.
Just a gift to the women of this world. Responsibility sits so hard on my shoulder. Like a good wine, I'm bitter as I grow older. And now I'm just a gift to the women of this world.
David Buss thinks that we can trace the differences in what men and women look for in a mate back to our Stone Age ancestry. Women with babies, he argues, would have been too busy to gather enough food for themselves and their offspring, so they needed men to hunt for them. The better a man was at hunting, the higher his status would have been within the hunter-gatherer group, so the more desirable he would have been as a mate.
In an evolutionary sense, women who selected men on the basis of their ability to acquire resources and their willingness to channel them to her, out-reproduced women who chose on other grounds. It became critical for a woman to have a male who could provide meat in the winter, for example, when the berries were not blooming, to provide for her and her children during lean times and when she herself was not in an optimal position to acquire all the resources herself.
Second best. After you've had me, you know that you've had the best, and now you know that I'm just a gift to the women of this world.
Looking far enough back in the stream of time, and judging from the social habits of man as he now exists, The most probable view is that he aboriginally lived in small communities, each with a single wife, or, if powerful, with several, whom he jealously guarded against all other men. The most powerful and able males would succeed best in obtaining attractive females. They would also succeed best in the general struggle for life and in defending their offspring, as well as their females, from enemies of all kinds. Charles Darwin, The Descent of Man, 1871.
The problem I have with a lot of this scenario is that what's in it for the females, really? Do they need these males to bring up their babies? It seems to me if human infants are so completely dependent on adults that you don't just need dad, you could actually have sisters and grandmothers, and this is how it works in hunter-gatherer society, that the groups are very small, they're kin-based, and everybody helps with the kids. So our Western idea of a nuclear family and mom and dad helping bring up the two kids and mom trading sex for dad's care just seems like a real Western bias.
Meredith Small, who's professor of anthropology at Cornell University. Small points out that what's true for hunter-gatherers today is likely to have been no less true for our ancestors on the savannah. And she's also critical of the way that David Buss surveyed the 10,000 participants in his study and of his claim to have demonstrated universal sex differences in men's and women's marital shopping lists.
They're often, most often done with college-age students who I don't think really represent the human mind. Let's hope not. Then in the details, in one of his studies, he looks at 14 characteristics that women and men rate on a scale of 1 to 7 or something. And of those characteristics, you have to go down the first 7 that men and women rate exactly the same until you come to a difference. And there you find that women are more interested in men of high status and men are more interested in looks. But what I think is interesting is that the first 7 are the same. And the very first one is kindness, that this is what people are most attracted to in a mate. And I think that's what's really interesting, not the differences that you have to kind of search down through the data for.
I don't think it's the case that men are from Mars and, you know, women are from Venus or whatever the that cliche is. It's not that we are not from two different planets, but we are not identical either. And the dominant dogma in psychology for this century has been that men and women are essentially identical in their underlying psychology. And the reason that this study was important is that showed that yes, we are similar in some respects, but there are also some fundamental differences, and we can't overlook those. They're part of our human nature. They're part of our sexual nature.
What's your name?
Jill.
Jill who?
Jill Masterson.
Tell me, Jill, why does he do it?
He likes to win.
Why do you do it?
He pays me.
Is that all he pays you for?
And for being seen with him.
Just seen?
Just seen.
I'm so glad.
Someone who has a slightly different spin on men's and women's mating choices is Sarah Hurdy, who's Professor of Anthropology at the University of California, Davis. Now, Hurdy thinks that the gender differences which David Buss has identified really do exist, but she says that they're not a product of evolution, but of economics.
I do not doubt that in societies where men monopolize resources, which of course is true in patriarchal societies which are patrilocal, men live among their kin, and you have male-biased access to resources and male-biased inheritance of resources, under those circumstances, it would be really kind of dumb for a woman not to choose on the basis of resources, because how else is she going to get the resources she needs to provide for herself and rear her children? But we have to keep in mind that this is one particular set of social and economic circumstances. And it's interesting to me that if you look carefully at sort of the gap between what they've shown and what they're claiming, the agenda that I see there, I see that these are, in a sense, men with a mission. The agenda that I see is a desire to prove that patriarchal social systems are somehow natural and the basic human condition, and I do not believe that the evidence at this point supports that conclusion.
Sarah Hurdy. Her latest book is Mother Nature, Natural Selection and the Female of the Species.
A kiss on the hand may be quite continental, but diamonds are a girl's best friend. A kiss may be grand, but it won't pay the rental on your humble flat or help you at the automat. Men grow cold as girls grow old, and we all lose our charms in the end.
Men grow cold as girls grow old. Marilyn Munro with what evolutionary psychologists believe is an eternal verity. But recently, the social psychologist Alice Agley has come up with some hard evidence which challenges this view. Like Sarah Hurdy, Agley believes that it's men's and women's economic position in society which determines their choice of mate, not their evolutionary programming.
Well, men and women choose differentially if they have differential roles, gender roles and family roles. So it would be true, for instance, that in those cultures where men are choosing homemakers, women are choosing providers. That's the division of labor.
In other words, there's a complementarity there. Yeah.
There's a complementarity about a provider and a homemaker, a domestic worker and a wage laborer. So when that division is strong, you would find both of those sex differences to be large. So they would be varying together cross-culturally.
Alice Agley, who's Professor of Psychology at Northwestern University in Chicago. She and her co-researcher, Wendy Wood, asked David Buss if he'd let them re-examine his raw data. David Buss very sportingly agreed. Agley and Wood used a United Nations Index of Gender Equality to rate all of the 37 cultures which Buss had looked at in his study. Then they set out to see whether levels of gender equality affected men's and women's mate preferences.
Well, we found in general what we expected, and that is that the critical sex differences that would go with a division of labor get smaller when you have more gender equality. So in the more equal societies, then the sex difference in it would have to do with women choosing providers and men choosing homemakers and women choosing older mates and men choosing younger mates. All those get smaller when you have more gender equality. Dramatically so in terms of the differential age selection. That's quite a large difference preferred in societies where women are very unequal, have much lower status than men. But all of them tended to show this pattern, except for the physical attractiveness difference. Men's tendency to choose more for physical attractiveness did not relate to gender equality, nor did we predict it would, because that really had no relation to our theory about homemakers and providers. It's not clear that women who are prettier are better homemakers, so that was not a predicted difference from our perspective.
Hi.
Modern mating, some contemporary cave persons getting sweaty at a dance party near Byron Bay. Now, of course, a lot of the mating that we do these days is for purely recreational reasons. But according to evolutionary psychology, the mental programming we developed in the Stone Age is still what's driving our deepest desires.
I make a distinction in my work between desires, which is what I have been describing here, and actual behavior. As the theoretician Mick Jagger of the Rolling Stones noted, you can't always get what you want. We don't expect people's desires to be automatically translated into behavior because they can't. What we expect is that people who are high in desirability, high-status men and physically attractive women, and who do they pick as potential mates? And studies that have done this have amply supported this. So the bottom line is that, yes, desires do get expressed in behavior.
Over and out. That should keep him occupied for quite some time.
I'm beginning to like you, Mr. Bond.
Oh, call me James.
More than anyone I've met in a long time, James.
Well, what on earth are we going to do about it?
Yes, what?
I'll tell you at dinner.
Where?
Well, I know the best place in town.
David is working on a concept that he calls desire. Mate attraction. Who is attracted to whom? What do people say about who they want as a mate? So the first reservation I have about that is that science really operates. The first thing you have to do is come up with a good, biologically meaningful question. And I question whether his idea of mate choice is biologically meaningful. I don't think that evolution or natural selection works on what we think or what we desire. It works on what we do. I don't think it really matters who we say we want as partners. It only matters who we have babies with. I like to call this the Tom Cruise Julia Roberts hypothesis. You know, I think Tom Cruise is really cute and I'm really attracted to him. And I'm sure the males in your audience think Julia Roberts is really cute and they're attracted to her. But you know, Tom and Julia are not interested in us. So we don't get them. They're our ideal. They're who we're attracted to. But we end up with someone that we met at a party, someone who introduced us through friends, someone we met at work. So all these questions about who you're attracted to, I don't think are evolutionarily meaningful.
Evolutionary psychology doesn't shy away from the fundamental doctrine of neo-Darwinism, that it's the genes, not us, who are in charge, and what the genes want is to make more genes. As Steven Pinker puts it, the ultimate goal that the mind was designed to attain is maximizing the number of copies of the genes that created it. Why is it then that our minds make us do so many things that seem to be at odds with our reproductive self-interest? Why, for example, do people tend to have fewer and fewer children as the societies they live in get more affluent? Why do they use contraception or join celibate religious orders? And why is it that some of us prefer to mate with someone of our own sex? There seems to be a contradiction here, but Steven Pinker insists that there isn't.
No, it's not a contradiction at all. The goal of evolution, kind of a metaphorical goal because evolution doesn't really have any goal, can be very different from the goal of the product of evolution, namely a human brain. And human life would be very different if each of us, if the brain actually calculated fitness in the biologist sense. Every one of us would have 13 or 14 kids or however many we could afford. And that's not the way people live their lives when they have a choice. And the reason is that the evolution worked by not by installing a fitness calculator in us, but by installing emotions in us that had the same effect in an ancestral environment. On average, if you fall in love and fear wild animals and snakes and like having friends and are curious about how the world works, you would have had more babies in an ancestral environment. But that's the best that evolution can do. And if the environment changes overnight, that same set of emotions that did produce biological fitness in an ancestral world need not do it if the world has been turned topsy-turvy.
In some ways, the view of the human condition which evolutionary psychology presents us with might seem to be a tragic one. Beneath the surface of thought, our evolved desires struggle to gain control of our hearts and minds and feed our most persistent fantasies.
I attribute the social and psychological problems of modern society.
In one sense, then, evolutionary psychology and the Unabomber have a similar worldview. Both of them believe that our deepest nature is out of kilter with the modern world, a world turned topsy-turvy. But evolutionary psychologists like Steven Pinker insist that theirs isn't a tragic or deterministic picture of human nature. Genes are not puppet masters, writes Pinker. They acted as the recipe for making the brain and body, and then they got out of the way. Stephen Rose thinks that this is having a bob each way.
Well, I find it a complete cop-out. On the one hand, we're told that we're hardwired, that we are genes' ways of making other genes. On the other hand, both Pinker and Dawkins, who put it in quite separate ways but are saying the same thing, Dawkins says, having in the back end of the selfish gene, having, as it were, proved that organisms, to his satisfaction, that organisms are simply genes' way of making other genes, that only we, that is humans, have the power to rebel against the tyranny of our selfish replicators. Pinker being, as it were, sort of New York, and if you like, sort of slightly more vulgar phrase than Richard puts it in a different way. He says, if my genes don't like what I do, they can go jump in the lake. Now, I don't know where they get this sudden sort of accretion of free will from. Where does it arrive from? It seems to me that what they want to do is to have free will coming galloping over the horizon like the American Fifth Cavalry to rescue themselves from the determinist position into which they painted themselves.
Very, very important, I think, to distinguish the metaphorical motive of genes from the real motive of people. Humans have goals, desires, emotions. Genes, in a metaphorical sense, have a particular goal, but they are not the same. And if I were to say what is the main message that I would like people to take away from How the Mind Works and of evolutionary psychology is that to understand ourselves, it is crucial to understand the evolutionary process, to understand the metaphorical motive of the genes, but you get nothing but trouble if you confuse that with the real motives of the human.
Of course we are the product of our genes in interaction with our environment through the complicated processes of development. And what is created out of these interactions is something which is qualitatively different from either the genes or the environment from which we started. And that's, if you like, the organism as a whole, the living system, open, interactive with its environment, and constantly recreating itself. Now, that is the nature of a living process, which doesn't require you suddenly to say there's free will coming in to rescue us from the genes. There's an extraordinary religious fundamentalism about the way in which the evolutionary psychologists argue, in which Darwin, or what they perceive as Darwin, replaces God, and this, as it were, unitary explanation is there. But somehow at the end of it, they have to find a way out, and I think they're in a logical trap.
You've been listening to The Science Show and the second episode of our special series, The Descent of Man. Technical production on today's program is by Judy Rapley. Lynn Malcolm is our executive producer, and the voice of Darwin was Tony Baldwin. Jim Miller was the Unabomber, and our special thanks to Radio Archives and Philip and Jane Ullman for location recordings in Tanzania. I'm Tom Morton, and join me next week for a little scandal. We find some neo-Darwinists and some postmodernists in bed together. See you then.